two hats, two choices in Nigeria. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Nigerians vote in a presidential election tomorrow, and you can learn a lot about the candidates by looking at what they wear on their heads.
The black Stetson that Goodluck Jonathan wears, you know, it represents Christianity, if you like, from the South. The hat that Muhammad Buhari wears represents someone who's a Muslim from the North.
Also, a Boston runner who signed up for this year's Paris Marathon before the Charlie Hebdo attacks.
I've set a goal. I'd like to finish it. And you can't let outside events affect your life and how you pursue your goals.
Plus, a short history of immunization in America. That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. There is so much at stake in Nigeria's presidential election tomorrow, and we're talking a country of contradictions. Africa's richest nation, but beset by corruption. It's also the continent's biggest democracy, but it's threatened by the extremist violence of Boko Haram. And last time Nigeria held a presidential vote, that was 2011, political violence followed. Hundreds of people died. This time, though, incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan and his main challenger, Muhammadu Buhari, are uniting to call for peace. Even our colleagues at the BBC are doing their part with public service messages like this one.
Election not do.
No be die matter. Vote, not fight.
Election no be war.
Vote, not fight. The BBC's Peter Okwoche is in Nigeria to cover the election. He told me earlier about the mood where he is in President Jonathan's home state.
Well, there's a lot of excitement here in Nigeria ahead of these elections. You know, given the fact that they were postponed 6 weeks ago, they're finally going to take place. But there is a certain amount of tension as well. There's been some pre-election violence, and people are hoping and praying that it doesn't escalate. It's a story that is quite normal with Nigeria in the run-up to elections and post-elections sometimes. So people just want the elections to pass peacefully.
Yeah, so how do Nigerians see this election? I know we've got two main candidates. Goodluck Jonathan is Christian from the South. He's the incumbent, the other candidate Muslim from the North, and a former military ruler in the country, General Muhammadu Buhari. So many opposites. What do Nigerians see as what's at stake with this election?
Well, I mean, let me just start with both parties. Now, the ruling PDP and the All Progressive Congress don't really have any differences, ideologically, that is. You know, I mean, they're both just right central parties. But Muhammadu Buhari said that he's coming to fight corruption. Don't forget that he was a former military leader, came into power through a coup on December 31st, 1983, and, you know, threw a lot of politicians who we called corrupt in jail. You know, there were lots of human rights abuses as well during his time. So he says he's coming up to clean up the system once more. But for Goodluck Jonathan, those people who support him well say, well, he, you know, he represents continuity. He's been there for 5.5 years now. There's also the Christian-Muslim divide. Muhammad Buhari, a Muslim from the North. Goodluck Jonathan, a Christian from the South. So there are similarities, but there are differences as well.
Yeah, so, I mean, with the security situation in Boko Haram, how has Buhari been distinguishing himself from Goodluck Jonathan?
Well, General Buhari says it's a shame that a military that he used to lead cannot rout Boko Haram, a terrorist organization made up of just a few thousand people. And given the fact that the Nigerian army is meant to be the largest in sub-Saharan Africa, so that's the first thing, one of the first things he's going to tackle. Now, on the other hand, Goodluck Jonathan says, look, we've recorded some victories in the last couple of weeks since the elections were postponed. Don't forget they were postponed for the insecurity in the Northeast. And just today, a statement released by the military spokesperson says that the Nigerian military has taken back the town of Gwoza in the northeast. Now, Gwoza was meant to be the capital of the caliphate that Boko Haram claim to have set up. So, you know, the news just comes in time to give President Goodluck Jonathan a huge boost.
Is that really the way it works? Nigerians are looking at the news and they see, oh, we're kind of taking care of Boko Haram. I will vote for Goodluck Jonathan. Is it that cut and clear?
Well, this kind of news is what could sway someone whose mind is not yet made up. For those people who are not supporters of Goodluck Jonathan, they'll say, well, you know, it's just too little, too late. And, you know, we'll vote for a man who we believe will come and finish the job quickly.
Let's talk about hats for a minute, Peter, because I saw this great video you produce in which you poll people in Nigeria about the two candidates, summing them up by their hat wear, a Stetson for Good Luck Jonathan, which has kind of become his trademark, and a Haji cap for Buhari, which is a sign that a man has made the pilgrimage to Mecca. Seriously, though, what useful knowledge about this election can we draw out through the hats?
The report was just meant to be a fun take on the elections, but it's pretty serious as well, because the black Stetson that Good Luck Jonathan wears, you know, it represents Christianity, if you like, from the south. And as you said, the hat that Muhammad Buhari wears represents someone who's a Muslim from the north. Now, it's not only Muslims that wear that hat. I've worn that hat before. I'm a Christian. And, you know, and you've got Muslims in the north who wear that same Stetson that Good Luck Jonathan wears. But, you know, these are the hats that these two men have become identified with. And, you know, it was just a fun play on how people were going to vote.
And, Peter, you're Nigerian. Will you be voting tomorrow? And where do you vote?
Well, unfortunately, Marco, I'm not allowed to vote because I don't live here and I don't pay my taxes. So I won't be voting. It'll just be my job to report on the elections.
My colleague at the BBC in Nigeria right now, Peter Okwoche, for the elections there. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Marco.
Reporter Julia Simon just returned from spending a year in Nigeria as part of a Fulbright fellowship. In fact, she was scheduled to cover the elections, but then they were delayed by 6 weeks, and she was not able to change her own schedule. So incumbent candidate President Good Luck Jonathan said the delay was because of the extremist group Boko Haram. Does that ring true to you, Julia?
Well, for a lot of Nigerians, that seems really convenient. Because basically 6 weeks ago, Jonathan wasn't doing very well in the polls, and he suddenly brought out this excuse, oh, we need to fight Boko Haram. And a lot of Nigerians kind of say to that, well, why haven't you been fighting Boko Haram for the past several years, let alone the past year where it's been particularly terrible? So I think for a lot of Nigerians, that sounds a little suspicious and convenient.
Have you been noticing any change in the Boko Haram situation in the past 6 weeks? Like, did that really make any difference?
Definitely there have been towns that the Nigerian army or they've been recapturing from Boko Haram. But again, the criticism of this is that it's actually the forces of Chad and Niger. And now you have allegations of South African mercenaries who are doing the work on behalf of the Nigerian army. Yes, they are making progress, but it's a question of who is really making progress.
So, I mean, especially for people in the south who are far away from the violence in the north, how big an issue is Boko Haram for them? Or are they just looking at the usual things, reliable electricity and clean water?
Yeah, I mean, for definitely for the people in the northeast where the insurgency is raging, it's a huge issue. But for other people around the country, it's not totally on their radar. I mean, it is on their radar, but the things they're thinking about are the economy, the fact that, yes, there's no electricity and the water is terrible and the economy is just in major trouble. The naira is falling. The Nigerian government relies on oil for 70% of its revenue. And with the oil price falling more than 50%, that's really bad news for the government. So a lot of Nigerian people are thinking about, you know, the economy, their pocketbooks, and the fact that things have just gotten really bad lately.
Now, the opposition candidate, Muhammadu Buhari, he's not a new face in Nigeria. He was the former dictator in the 1980s. What's his appeal to Nigerians today?
Well, it's funny because he was a military dictator and Good Luck Jonathan was putting out these documentaries about Buhari as this ruthless dictator. And the funny thing is, I talked to a Nigerian who saw this movie and kind of thought, well, that's kind of appealing. Somebody with discipline, somebody who can control people. Because the thing is, today, Nigeria, the corruption is so out of hand. For many Nigerians, it's kind of mind-boggling. Last year, the central bank governor declaring that tens of billions of dollars were missing, that the oil ministry failed to remit it to the treasury. And so a lot of people look at Buhari, this former military dictator, and think, if he could get the corruption under control, I would vote for that guy.
Yeah, but military regimes in Nigeria have also been corrupt. So, I mean, we look at this and we see this is one of those classic change versus continuity decisions that Nigerians are going to have to make. But when you press them hard, at the end of the day, They really believe that continuity is a good thing, or do they really believe that if Buhari were elected, anything would really change?
Well, a year ago, I talked to some people who were fervent Jonathan supporters. Many of them were from his region. And today, they're looking to vote for Buhari. So they are really fed up with continuity, if continuity means this ongoing corruption and the growing gap between the rich and poor. I mean, continuity doesn't look too good for a lot of Nigerians.
Yeah, why not?
Basically, you have the middle class just shrinking. Prices for food and prices for housing and prices for education, you have to pay for school fees, are really going up, and the naira is falling. And just daily life is a struggle for many Nigerians. They are looking for someone to make things a bit more equal and kind of cut down on the malfeasance, the corruption of the government, which is the current Jonathan regime. And the problem is that there's just this culture of impunity where basically most Nigerians just look at the fact that, oh, well, our leaders can get away with corruption and nothing happens to them. So why shouldn't I? I'm just looking for a few dollars.
Reporter Julia Simon there. She spent the last year in Nigeria on a Fulbright fellowship. She also explored the country's oil and gas sector for the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. And now a couple of voices from Nigeria's musical front lines.
Hi, everybody. I'm Paul.
And I'm Peter.
Together we are P-Square. This is our brand new single, Collabo, P-Square featuring Don Jazzy.
Make sure you enjoy it. We love you all.
Much love.
These two brothers see themselves as playing a key role for their nation.
Yeah, you know, what we do for a living keeps people happy.
But the brothers are realistic, too, with all the problems in Nigeria that we've been hearing about, like Boko Haram and corruption. They know their music can only be a temporary distraction for people.
After entertaining them, they come for a concert, they're dancing, but after they go back to their worries. But I wish they could listen to our music forever to forget their worries. But, you know, these people have to go back to work. They have to go ahead with their daily lives, and the same problem still lives on them.
Problems as basic as, will there be electricity so my refrigerator will work? Will there be clean water at my house? Can I commute to work in less than 2 hours? Not to mention, can my government keep me safe from Boko Haram? That's why Peter and Paul Okoye, the two P's in P Square, believe there is so much at stake in Nigeria's presidential vote tomorrow.
It's very, very important because all eyes are on Nigeria at the moment. Just need someone to put things right. So people need to vote wisely at the moment. Don't vote based on sentiment. Vote wisely.
It'll be interesting either way the vote goes tomorrow in Nigeria. Coming up later on The World Today, we introduce you to another musical act. His name is Stromae, and after lighting the European music scene on fire, he's now bringing his dance sounds stateside. Stick around and listen in for that. Here's some more P-Square for you. Are tuned to The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Here in Boston, the trial of admitted marathon bomber Johar Tsarnaev continues. Today was a day off, but there's a lot for the jurors to digest from earlier in the week. That includes graphic photos from one victim's autopsy and a crash course on global terrorism. Prosecutors put Matthew Levitt on the stand to explain how it works and connect the dots back to Tsarnaev. Levitt's a terrorism expert with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. My WGBH colleague Philip Martin was in court for his testimony, and I asked him if Levitt was trying to portray Cambridge, Massachusetts, where Tsarnaev lived, as a terrorist breeding ground.
No, he wasn't trying to portray Cambridge as a breeding ground. What he was trying to do is to show that there are lone wolves among terrorists around the world. He was trying to paint Johar Tsarnaev and his brother as lone wolves. And what he did, Marco, was he basically took us on a tour of the world initially, stopping in Chechnya, stopping in Syria, stopping in Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, places where bases exist for al-Qaeda and ISIS. He basically tried to say that, look, there are places where you have command and control acts of terrorism where people are training on bases. He said that's old school. He said new school are lone wolves. New school would be people who are inspired by magazines like Inspire magazine from al-Qaeda, which the prosecution said was found on Johar Tsarnaev's hard drives. What the prosecution was trying to say, and Levitt buttresses with his testimony, was that Johar Tsarnaev did not take inspiration simply from his brother. It was not a question of a domineering brother, as the defense contends, in terms of why he engaged in the Boston Marathon bombing. But he engaged because he was inspired. This was the reason for Levitt's testimony.
Yes, so how did the defense reply to that kind of assertion? Because he's trying to tie Johar into major terrorist groups around the world, and the defense is saying he was just a follower.
Well, two things I think the defense sought to do. First of all, they pointed out he was paid for his testimony. He's a paid government witness. $450 an hour, he admitted on the stand.
$450 an hour.
For his testimony. And they also tried to show him as being an opportunist. That very night, I should say on Monday, he tweeted, apparently, to 7,000 of his followers. This is what the defense said. 7,000 of his followers. He tweeted information that had been or media accounts of his testimony on Monday. And the defense said, well, what's that all about? That seems a bit opportunistic.
So all of this trial is to prove that Johar Tsarnaev is guilty, but his defense team has already admitted as much. So some might wonder, what's the point of a trial? But there is a legal process that has to be followed. Makes me wonder, though, that after you step out of the courtroom after hours, Philip, are you getting a sense from the city of Boston that this trial is providing some sense of closure, some point to move on?
Actually, it seems to the contrary. I've spoken to a number of people who feel that this trial should not have proceeded. Now, many of these people, of course, are lawyers, but also I've spoken to ordinary citizens who were surprised to learn that the prosecution failed to come to an agreement with the defense to basically take the death penalty off the table. The contention by some is that if you had taken the death penalty off the table, if this was not a question of this individual facing the death penalty, they felt that the defense would have come to some type of agreement, that this would not have proceeded, and that the city would not have gone through this. Other people I spoke with, however, see this as a necessary catharsis, that there had to be some type of cleansing. And the only way to air some of the details, horrible details, of injuries and limbs lost was in the context of a trial.
Philip Martin from the WGBH newsroom, covering the trial of admitted Boston Marathon bomber Johar Tsarnaev. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Since January this year, Boston and Paris have sadly encountered common ground. That's what the story of this next person is about. On the day that the bombs tore through crowds near the finish line here in Boston, Mackenzie Loy was hoping to finish her first Boston Marathon. She was running with her dad. Like thousands of other runners that day, though, they did not finish. Organizers stopped the race after the explosions. But the father and his daughter lined up again to run in 2014, and nothing stopped them. Mackenzie spoke recently with my WGBH colleague Elizabeth Ross and described what she and her dad were feeling as they neared the finish line last year.
To be honest, we weren't running too fast at that point, and we were able to talk a little bit. He was saying, you know, this is the last marathon I'm running. I did this for myself. I did this for you. But this is the last one. And I said, that's quite all right. Just look around, you know, soak it up. All of these people are cheering for you. When we crossed the line, there's a few tears. It was a very emotional moment.
After that, Mackenzie Loy set her sights on running another marathon this year. She'll be traveling to Paris soon, another city traumatized recently by a terrorist attack.
I made my decision to run the Paris Marathon this year before any attacks, before the Charlie Hebdo incidences, before any military action. And I paused when, you know, the news first broke about that. And it's something that my mom and I had a long conversation about, because it's not just me that I'm bringing into the situation. Once again, you know, my family will be at the finish line. They'll be along the race course. They'll be in the city. And it's not just me. And that's something that I have reconsidered, in the fact that I've reconsidered my plan of action. I've reconsidered, do we have an emergency plan? But I've never reconsidered my decision to run. I think that, again, this is like last year. I've set a goal. I'd like to finish it. And you can't let outside events affect your life and how you want to pursue each day and pursue your goals.
Mackenzie Loy is planning to run the Paris Marathon next month. She told her story to producer Elizabeth Ross here at WGBH in Boston. A quick look now at what's coming up later on the show today. We've got the story of a Syrian activist on the verge of getting out of his country. He's been awarded a fellowship for young leaders here in the U.S. at Syracuse University.
It's another land with another faces and another people. You might laugh, but it would be something like psychological treatment for me after being out of jail. I'm still shy. I'm still having bad dreams.
But all he needs is a passport, and he'll be on his way to America. In war-torn Syria, though, getting a passport is not easy. Hear the rest of his story coming up after the news, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Still ahead on The World, pop history quiz for you. Who is the first American to really figure out that immunization might be a good thing? And the answer is,
in fact, the founding father of mass immunization in America is none other than George Washington himself.
And where did George Washington get the idea? Stick around for the answer ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Syria and Somalia, they happen to be two of the most unstable countries on Earth, and we're going to hear stories from both places in the next few minutes. In a moment, how parents here in the U.S. are trying to cope with children who've run off to join militant groups in Somalia. First, though, to Syria and the story of a young man named Kerem Al-Hamad. Reporter Marine Olivezi brings us his story of getting caught between the regime he hated and the Islamic radicals he feared.
I first met Kerem in May 2013 in the battered city of Deir Zor. He helped me out as a translator, guide, protector. We became friends and stayed in touch. On Sunday, Kerem, now in Turkey, called me up with good news. He had been accepted for a fellowship in the U.S. at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Public Affairs. He had just picked up his visa and was booked on a flight to New York the next day.
This country is only for United States flights. Everyone in here is for United States.
Monday morning, we meet up at the airport.
So how are you feeling?
I didn't sleep, actually.
Kerem's anxious, for good reason. Turkey is the only foreign country he's visited. He's barely been on a plane. But those concerns are the least of his troubles.
Are you sure you don't have any travel documents with you?
No.
This is the ID. Expired passport or something else?
No.
Anything?
I have only the Syrian ID also.
Kerem has got no passport. The U.S. consulate delivered his visa on a piece of paper from the State Department and told him he was good to go. But the immigration officers here don't know what to do with him.
So I need to ask police?
Yeah.
Because they are making passport control.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
The answer came fast.
Call the passport. Okay, no passport, no flight.
No passport, no flight. For about an hour, Karam barely says a word. The blow is hard to stomach. Passport seemed like his curse. Trying to get one landed him in jail. Karam was 20 when protests against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad broke out in 2011. Some of his friends took up arms and joined the Free Syrian Army. Karam picked up his camera and started documenting the war. In 2013, he ran Deir Zor's media center. That's how we met. The town was split between the rubble and regime-controlled sides of town. He worked on the rubble side. His parents lived on the regime side. Every now and again, he would sneak there to visit them. In August 2013, he went again on a mission. Karam never had a passport, but needed one to travel to Turkey for work. One of his relatives on the regime side told him he could arrange it. Karam trusted him and fell into a trap. Regime forces took him, then went to his house. Karam's younger brother was there.
They barged in and they just searched the house. And they were looking for computers and hard drives and mobile phones. Then they said, wear some clothes and come with us.
For a month, the two brothers were separated, interrogated, beaten up, and interrogated again. At first, Karam didn't know what the investigators knew exactly about him. After a couple of weeks, he found out he and his brother were on a list of 17 names that were given by one of their high school friends. The charge against them? Working with the Mossad, Israel's spy agency. For Karam, the accusation was ludicrous, but it was a blessing because they had no record of him as an activist. The investigator asked for names of his Israeli network.
I told him Iker Casillas. Iker Casillas is a player for Real Madrid.
When he wrote Iker Casillas, I told him Wesley Schneider.
And there's another football player?
Yeah, he heard the shh, so he thought that he was a Jewish. He kept writing. So I kept giving him some names.
And that, crazily enough, did the trick. Karam says the investigators were jubilant, as if they'd cracked some big case. They sent him and his brother to Damascus. Interrogation sessions weren't as rough as in Deir Zor, but Karam says the real torture there was detention itself. He and his brother were crammed in with 120 people in a single room that also included the bathroom. 73 of their roommates died. Karam remembers one old man having a heart attack in the middle of the night.
He was going to die, so maybe at 2 or 3 a.m. I was knocking on the door, calling the guards to come and get him out. After an hour or more, he came and he said, once he's his breath and dies, call me again and let him go out with the rubbish.
Hiding early for the daily races, going nowhere.
It's a mad world. The brothers say they'd hum that song whenever they felt they were about to lose it. They didn't know it then, but their mother had moved to Damascus and was showing up in court every day, hoping to hear from them. She was there when the judge finally dropped all charges in June last year, almost 11 months after their arrest. Karam moved to Turkey in the fall, snuck across the border like tens of thousands of other refugees. He's been working here with Syrian dissidents, but says he feels mostly powerless to change anything back home. And he's still scarred by his time in jail. Going to the U.S., he hopes, might help him move on.
You might laugh, but it would be something like psychological treatment for me after being out of jail. I'm still shy, I'm still having bad dreams. I don't want to miss it. I hope I won't.
Karam has spent this past week working the phones to get some sort of passport waiver. He's not entirely sure how it'll go, but he's booked on a flight today. Wish him luck. For the world, I'm Marine Olivesi in Istanbul.
It's not hard to understand why young people like Karam want to flee from countries gripped by extremism. More difficult to fathom is why others are lured to countries in turmoil to join the extremists. And actually, radical recruiters have been preying on naive Western youth for longer than you might think. 17-year-old honor student Burhan Hassan was convinced he had to leave Minnesota and join the Somali extremist group Al-Shabaab 7 years ago. That decision still does not make sense to his uncle, Somali-American Abdirizak Bihi. He remembers the night his nephew left. It was on the eve of Election Day, November 2008. Bihi thought Hassan was on the streets of Minneapolis, knocking on doors on behalf of candidate Barack Obama.
His mom, my sister, was worried that he didn't come home as usual that evening. And she called me and other family members. And personally, I told her, hey, he's 17. Don't worry about him. Maybe he's out there door knocking for the election. As our community was really excited about that election. Mm. And early in the morning, with that motherly instinct, she found out his passport and other materials were gone.
Did he leave a note or anything?
Nothing. We wish nothing. Then we started making phone calls to East African, Kenyan relatives and former Somali consulate. And we find out they were traveling. Before we have done that, the first thing we have done is we went to the law enforcement and reported what was happening to us.
Now, your nephew, what happened to him once he got to Somalia?
Well, he was the youngest to date that was recruited and brainwashed. He got homesick. He refused to fight and or get the training. He became a liability to them, and he was killed by the son of the former Al-Shabaab leader.
Yeah, terrible story. Do you think that he regretted his decision once he got there?
Yes, he did. Most of these young people regret because when they get there, they don't find the Ethiopian society. They find executions. They find the worst things in their life, something that they have not been told.
Since your nephew died there, more than 27 Somali Americans from Minnesota have disappeared to fight for Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Now ISIS is recruiting in the Twin Cities as well. Are you able to explain why this is happening in the Twin Cities?
ISIS is recruiting from all over the world, and about 180 Americans. Somali Americans in Minnesota are the minority of this number. But one thing I can tell you is that the Somali American community is the poorest community in Minnesota and continues to suffer the highest unemployment in the state of Minnesota.
And you see a connection to the recruitment?
Yes. In my community where I live, which is called Little Mogadishu or Little Somalia, has the highest number of young people per density of land in the Midwest.
It sounds like it's a tight community, a tightly knit community, yeah?
Yes. Let me tell you, in the building I live or in those high rises, we used to leave our doors open so the neighbors can come in and get banana. And you know, banana is very important in our East African or Somali food. So get banana or tomato or whatever you need. So we depend on each other. We support each other. And that's how we survive with a chronic high unemployment, about 40% in a state where the unemployment rate is 3%.
Wow. So given how tightly knit things are in the Twin Cities, if there are face-to-face recruitments going on the ground, wouldn't people say this is dangerous and tell the authorities?
Yes, the community is talking to each other. They are figuring out who's doing this. They are working with the authority, and we strongly are against this.
When was the last time you met a young man or woman in the Twin Cities and thought, I got to keep an eye on them?
Well, I don't keep eye on people or young people, but we engage them, and we see challenged young people every now and then. And they are challenged because they cannot find opportunities to find employment or join a positive programming like after school. The key here is resources. You have a community that's really trying very hard to chase the American dream, and at the same time that lacks the tools and the resources to reach that dream.
Abdirizak Bihi directs the Somali Education and Social Advocacy Center in Minneapolis in Minnesota. Thank you very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
We hear a lot about immigrants who come to the U.S. and build lives here. We hear less about those who return to their home countries. This next story turns that around, though. We head to Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, to a small town where there's been plenty of back and forth with the San Francisco Bay Area. Reporter Monica Ortiz Uribe takes us there.
In the city of Ochkutska, in the heart of Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, a man toots his bicycle horn as he pedals down the narrow streets. He's selling sweet bread for a few pesos apiece. It's a meager way to make a living. Jobs like this have pushed about one-third of Ochkutska's population to migrate north.
I live my heart on San Francisco.
Fernando Buenfil Góngora boasts the ultimate immigrant success story. He owns the Hotel Clásico, built with 15 years' worth of money earned busing tables and bartending in San Francisco.
I have the Golden Gate Bridge here, and I have another cable car here.
Buenfil points to murals inside his small hotel, a shrine to San Francisco. The top floor features rooms with bay windows, and the hotel keeps most of his family employed.
I'm okay. I can survive with this. I'm not making like that much like in San Francisco, but I'm happy to be here with my family.
But Buenfil confesses leaving San Francisco was like swearing off a mistress. He misses the city, so much so that he's cut off all contact with his friends there. He fears being pulled back.
Because I feel like part of my life is in San Francisco. I feel like if I go there, I'm going to stay. So I don't want to leave my family.
Ochkutska is far from tourist magnets like Cancun. Here, the poverty rate is high, but the consistent flow of dollars sent from workers in the U.S. nurtures a modest middle class. So you see new trucks and smartphones here. There's two-story American-style homes built next to traditional adobe huts.
Soy Juan Carlos Chablé Cocón. Soy mototaxista.
As a teenager, Juan Carlos Chablé Cocún would wake up at 3 a.m. to unload crates of pineapple destined for the downtown market in Ochkutska. When he married, he moved his bride in with his parents.
No podía. No me alcanza para nada, solo para la comida.
I was barely making enough to feed us, he says. So Chablé spent 2 years in San Francisco kneading pizza dough and washing dishes. He saved up enough to move back to Ochkutska and build a four-room home with a patio and a fancy wrought iron gate. He now has two kids and owns a motorcycle taxi. On a good week, he makes the equivalent of $120.
Entonces, creo que voy por el segundo viaje. Mi esposa se...
I want to go back to San Francisco, he says. I have hospital bills to pay off. Chablé also wants to save up and open his own car wash. But those who stay behind, mostly women and children, are less convinced that immigration is a solution to their money troubles. Next door, Chablé's mother, Sofia, rinses a chicken before lunch. She scoffs at her son's desire to leave again.
Está loco. Pero ahorita tiene su casa, tiene su mototaxi para trabajar.
He's crazy, she says. He has his house and a motor taxi for work. What's he missing, she asks. He's got everything he needs.
¿Y qué le falta? No falta nada.
Meanwhile, in a nearby neighborhood, Maria Juvencia Chan swats flies off chunks of raw pork. She and her husband run a small butcher shop and food stand. With their earnings, they've raised two kids, built a home, and drive a 2005 Jetta. Neither has migrated to the U.S. for work. Chan takes pride in this.
No, es difícil, en todos lados es difícil, pero si uno se esfuerza.
It's difficult no matter where you go, she says, but if you apply yourself and work hard, you can make it in Mexico. For The World, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe, Ochkutska, Mexico.
Ever heard of Stromae? Millions have, you're about to. On The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Our partners at Frontline on PBS premiered a new documentary this week, Vaccine Wars, about the controversy over the practice of vaccinating children against common diseases. As he does occasionally, the world's history guy, Chris Wolf, helped produce a video explaining this issue. So, Chris, vaccinations and anti-vaxxers, it's been a big story the past 6 months or so since this Disney measles outbreak. You go back much further, as historians are wont to do, a few hundred years or so, yeah?
Yeah, I was curious to see just how far back it goes in America, the controversy over immunization. And I was surprised to find that, yeah, it's about 300 years. And in fact, the founding father of mass immunization in America is none other than George Washington himself.
Right. And just briefly, what did he do?
Well, I don't want to recap everything in the video, but basically smallpox was a huge problem for the Continental Army. So he instituted a program, you know, a couple of years into the war to make sure everybody in the Continental Army and associated with it was inoculated against smallpox.
Well, we'll have that video online at PRI.org, but give us some of the cutting room floor stuff, the things that you found were cool along the way that did not make it into that video.
Let's start with a number. I love a good number to set this frame.
Sure.
How many people do you think died of smallpox in the 20th century, given that it was completely eradicated by 1979?
So you're talking around the world?
Correct.
I'm going to say 150,000.
300 to 500 million.
300 to 500 million,
and that's
around the globe.
Vaccination saving millions of lives. Yes, it's that deadly, and it's kind of like, whoa, mind blowing. So that's fact number one that didn't get into the video. The other one is something I think you'll like, Marco. Is we talk about inoculation. This is pre-vaccination. This is where you actually give someone the disease itself, and you hope it's in a mild form. And it's something that was practiced in Asia for a long time. And I bet you can't guess how colonial Americans first learned about it.
How colonial Americans first learned about inoculation. Was it from somebody from the East who had amazingly settled in New York or Boston?
Well, Asia wasn't the only place that they did inoculation. It was already common in West Africa. So the first person documented to talk about it in the what became the United States is a black slave called Onesimus, who belonged to none other than the Reverend Cotton Mather of the Salem witch trials.
That's incredible.
And this poor chap was given to Cotton Mather as a Christmas or birthday present by his congregation, because that's kind of how colonials rolled. So he asked him, have you ever had smallpox? And he said, well, yes and no. Mather's got this all documented in letters that he wrote to his colleagues around the world. And he explained how, yes, back home, if people have enough courage, they submit to this process where they get a little bit of the smallpox in their arm from somebody with a mild case, and then they have immunity. And I would love to have gotten that in, because it gives a great kind of view of a great lie to this racist myth that Africans are somehow inferior when they're all medically like so far advanced in this one particular area.
That's pretty spectacular. Finally, Chris, as long as we're on the subject of smallpox, is it true that the Brits tried to infect Native Americans with smallpox by exchanging blankets?
I've heard this so many times, I thought it was just some trope. So I was really skeptical about this. So I dug deep and tragically found the original documents authorizing it from a couple of generals in the aftermath of the French and Indian War. We don't know that it actually happened, but certainly at a high level, it was condoned as something that could be done. So let's hope it didn't, because that's just awful.
The world's one-man history desk, Chris Snopes Wolf. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Who the hell is Stromae? Well, if you'd been at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas last week like I was, you'd have wondered. There were posters everywhere asking that exact question. So, who the hell is Stromae?
My real name is Paul Van Haver, and my stage name is Stromae. I'm 30 years old, and I'm a singer, composer, and yeah.
And yeah, what he didn't mention is he's an internet superstar. His music videos get hundreds of millions of views. He's collaborated with artists like Kanye West and Lorde. It's all pretty good for a guy from Belgium who sings in French.
Alone. 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 Qui dit études dit travail. Qui dit taf te dit les thunes. Qui dit argent dit dépense. Qui dit crédit dit créance. Qui dit dette te dit
huissier. Stromae and I sat down for a few minutes in a noisy kitchen behind the stage where he was about to perform. I learned, first of all, that his stage name is a riff in French Pig Latin for the word maestro.
I was born and raised in Brussels, and my mother was at home alone, and my Yeah, actually, I didn't know my father very well, so it's difficult to talk about him, of course. So that's my story. It's not a difficult story. It's just a story like everybody.
Stromae's absentee father was Rwandan. When Stromae was a boy, his dad left the family in Belgium and went back to Rwanda. He was killed during that country's genocide in 1994. Stromae writes about not having a father in his life in the song Papa Ute, which translates as, "Hey Papa, where are you?" Où est ton papa? Dis-moi où est ton papa? Sans même devoir lui parler, il sait ce qui ne va pas. Ah sacré papa, dis-moi où es-tu caché? Ça doit faire au moins mille fois que j'ai compté mes doigts. Hey. Où t'es papa, où t'es? Où t'es papa, où t'es? Où t'es papa, où t'es? The video to this song is quirky and plays like a children's book come to life. In it, a young boy vies for his father's attention, but the father, who is played by Stromae, is a lifeless mannequin. It's poignant and very popular. You remember what I said about Stromae, the internet star? That video has been viewed over 240 million times. He's also sold millions of albums and performs to sell out crowds. Even the Prime Minister of Belgium gave President Obama a Stromae CD as a gift. Then again, Stromae's groove comes from so many sources. There's something in his music that will appeal to everyone.
It's so obvious for me, and it was so obvious to mix all those influences, hip-hop music, French folk music, African music, Congolese rumba, music of Cesaria Evora, for example. So that's different kind of music that I wanted to mix together.
And Stromae takes us out today. This is his song Formidable. The video for this track is also very cool. We've got it up at PRI.org. It plays like candid camera with Stromae stumbling around the streets of Brussels, yelling and acting drunk. Even the police stop him at one point to ask him if he's okay. The stats there, over 100 million views. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, wishing you a great weekend. Oh, bébé, oups, mademoiselle, je vais pas vous draguer. Promis juré, je suis célibataire depuis hier, putain. Je peux pas faire d'enfant et bon, c'est pas, hey, reviens, 5 minutes quoi. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. More at skoll.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by the Ford Foundation, and the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nora Hall, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org. PRI, Public Radio International.